June 1622 continued. Oceanus lay sick all that week. He coughed and coughed, and neither Dr. Fuller's syrup nor anything that Elizabeth could concoct seemed to help him. He ate barely a mouthful, and his little belly growled with hunger, though it rounded grotesquely. If only there were some milk for him, I could warm it, and drop an egg in it, if there were any eggs. Elizabeth rocked a little to and fro, her arms folded hard across her breast as she sat beside the big bed where Oceanus lay. His dark eyes were closed, and there were great shadows beneath them, and his hair was in flat brown whorls from the sweat. I picked up the damp cloth she had been using as a sugar tit, and smeared it again with the last of the wild honey. "Try this," I said. "Mayhap you will suck a little of it." She took it from me, but shook her head the while. "Poor baby," she murmured, "poor little boy." She touched her son's dry lips gently with the honeyed cloth, but the child only whimpered and turned his head away. "There's some porridge left from breakfast," I said. "I could add some hot water to soften it for him." "He cannot keep it down," Elizabeth's voice broke. And then, as though she spat the word from her mouth, she said, "Corn." "But 'tis all we have," I began, and was interrupted by a storm of words, the like of which I had never heard from my stepmother before. "I am sick to death of corn. I wish I had never to look at it, nor taste it, nor touch it, nor speak of it again. I want white bread for my baby, and milk, and eggs, and sugar, and good English beef, and a rasher of bacon, and a fresh fowl. Not these wild birds with their scent and taste of wildness. I want fresh apples from which to make cider, and clear brown ale, and a leg of mutton. My mouth waters for mutton. Oceanus could eat it. His teeth are strong enough. But corn, corn, corn. My baby is dying from corn. Oh, Constance, what can I do for him?" And suddenly Elizabeth put her head down on the bed and cried until I thought she would tear herself apart with the great racking sobs. Never had I heard her cry before, not even when little Maris died, never. And this was as though all the tears and sadness and hopelessness of her whole life had suddenly burst out in a torrent of grief. To see Elizabeth cry, Elizabeth, who was so strong, so unshakable, so calm, who always dried the tears of others and never shed them herself. If ever a heart was broken for someone else, mine did then for her. I dropped to my knees on the floor beside her and put my arms around her. "Don't, Mother," I said. "Mother, please don't cry." I held her like that, rocking a little back and forth as she had rocked before, and realizing that for the first time in my life I had truly called her Mother. Yet somehow I felt that I was the Mother, and that I held in my arms Elizabeth, the child. The sobs went on, a little softer, but choking her so that I could feel her whole body shake. "Hush," I whispered. "Mother, hush thy tears. Thou wilt fright the babe." Instinctively her hand went out toward Oceanus, resting gently against his tiny wrist. Then I felt her stiffen, and the weeping ceased on an indrawn breath. Slowly she drew away from my arms, leaning toward her son, her eyes widened, tear-washed, her face streaked. She sat gazing at him, her hand moving, trembling, from his wrist to his little chest, until it lay softly across his lips. And then, in a voice I could barely hear, but one that was cleared of all weeping, she said, "Nothing can fret the babe now, Constance. The babe is dead." John Alden made his little coffin, and Mother and Giles brought a great flat stone they had found, heaving and sweating with the weight of it, and laid it gently atop the tiny grave. Afterwards, Father and Elizabeth walked slowly home again, and I started to follow. "Con, walk with me a bit," Giles said. I looked at him in surprise. "Of course." We walked slowly down the street, Giles scuffing up little clouds of dust as he went. His head drooped, and the long front lock of his blonde hair that never stays in place moved softly up and down against his forehead with every step. The lower gate in the palisade stood open, and Stephen Dean was on guard duty. "You buried the child?" he asked. I nodded. "May we walk down to the water?" "Go, there is no reason why you should not." Giles and I went through the gate, and as I passed him, Stephen laid his hand on my arm so that I looked up at him, his red hair flaming in the sun. "I'm sorry," he said. "He was a bonny lad." Not quite trusting my voice, I managed to smile and nodded at him again. And Giles and I went on down the path to the beach. We walked for a while, neither of us saying anything, and then we came to the spot where John Cook and I had sat that day, the day he kissed me. "Let's sit here for a while," I said to Giles. He dropped down beside me on the sand, resting his chin on his drawn-up knees and staring out at the water. I watched him, noting with sudden wonder how he had grown. His eyes blue like mine, and with the same long, thick lashes that often hid our eyes, gazed unblinkingly into the distance. Presently he spoke, his voice husky and nigh as deep as a man's. "I thought the New World would be a great adventure, Con." "It is," I answered. There should be enough adventure here to do you all your life. But it is not as I had imagined. I saw myself accomplishing great things, fighting battles single-handed against tribes of Indians, though I did not even know what an Indian looked like, discovering gold and mayhap even precious stones that would make me as rich as the king, building a home that would be finer and bigger and greater than anything I had ever seen. He paused, not lifting his eyes from the rhythmic movement of the sea. I hope you will never have to fight Indians, I said. But you might well do the other things. In a land as great as this, there must surely be gold. Ay, and jewels, too. Mayhap you will find them some day. Mokon, there will be no chance for that. All our days must be spent in simply making a land that others can live in with more comfort. Is it Oceanus who made you feel thus? In part. Oh, I grant you, he might have died in London, too. There are many who do. But our mother is right. If he could have been cosseted a bit, fed the things he could have had. No one else has them either. It's not only Oceanus. But they must. There must be cattle sent to us. And chickens, and other animals. We must plant more crops and raise more. Surely there is something that will grow here besides corn. We must build better homes, raise sheep for wool so that we may have clothes that are not a mass of holes and mending. Start orchards that there may be apples and plums and pears and peaches. But while we must all plant and tend crops for the common good, to put them in a common store, there seems little desire to work, I said. Father says each man feels he is working as hard for his neighbor as for himself. There is no incentive. Then somehow we must work for ourselves. Do we go on like this? He shrugged. No, this is not the way. I must talk to Father. I could not help smiling at him. You sound like a man, Giles. I am all but 15. Had you forgotten? We sat quietly for a few moments, watching the waves slide in and break against the sand, my eyes traveling far out across the water. We will never go back to England, will we, Giles? I doubt we do. He paused, and then, not looking at me, do you mind very much, Con? I thought carefully before I answered. Not so much, I said slowly. It seems different somehow, with both Maris and Oceanus staying here. We could not all go home together. Not any more. But you still call it home. Aye, I did, didn't I? Perhaps home can be where one comes from, as well as where one lives. Or mayhap it is where things, events, happen to us. The place where our lives wind through each day, building something strong from every joy, and every little victory, from every trouble, even from death. It may be that these are what make home. As though embarrassed at his own seriousness, he cleared his throat, and then got to his feet, offering me his hand to help me up. We had best go back now, I think, to put the cradle in the loft where our mother need not see it all the time. Elizabeth was just serving the small portion of supper into the trenches when we entered, and Father made us come to the board. I saw Giles glance at the cradle, and Elizabeth, as she so often does, must have seen him too, and read his thoughts. You were going to move it? She asked. Giles nodded. She patted his shoulder, already higher than her own. Better to leave it, she said. There will be another baby very early in the spring. Father cleared his throat and took his place at the head of the board. As he bowed his head and began the blessing, I saw him reach out and take Elizabeth's hand in his, and they stood thus until we sat down to eat our meal. September 1622. I think I am in love. At night I lay in my own room, for Father and the Teds have built two small rooms on the back of our house, one for stores and one for me, and I dream of that flaming redhead. A dozen times a day I start from what I am doing when I imagine I hear his voice. In the midst of my works I fall to thinking of his hands on my waist. They can span it with ease. I find myself wanting to walk where I think I shall see him, and then when I do I am tongue-tied and can bare speak a word. The time I was first aware of how I felt was a night of rain so heavy that it lashed its sheets against the house, running in rivers down the street, sun drops splattering down the chimney to hiss in the fire. Our evening meal, made tastier by the addition of two rabbits Stephen had trapped, had been shared by the hunter himself and by the two Teds, who, ever since that fearsome duel, find great comfort in each other's company and treat me with grave formality. When we had done eating, Father brought out the last of his precious brandy. He even gave a small portion to Giles, and we all sat by the fire, talking of England and of the way life used to be. Father was telling of the merrymaking on May Day and on Christmas, and suddenly Ted Doty jumped from his stool and clambered on the ladder to the loft, two rungs at a time. We heard him scrambling about up there, and a moment later, there came the thin, sweet notes of a flute piping the gayest tune ever I heard. Down the ladder he came again, one hand holding the flute to his lips, his eyes filled with glee. Elizabeth's face lighted with pleasure, and she clapped her hands almost like a child. "Oh, Ted," she cried, "you have a flute. You never showed us before." "There has seemed little time for amusement, ma'am," he said. "I had forgot I had it." "Oh, play for us," Elizabeth begged. "Play something happy." Ted needed no coaxing. He sat on the floor by the fire, leaning his back against the chimney piece, and played his flute. It was like magic. My toes started tapping of their own volition, and the first thing I knew, Stephen was on his feet, pulling me to mine. "Come, lass, dance with me." But, I know not how," I stammered. "Can't dance? What kind of an English girl are you?" He looked at me in mock despair. I was never taught," I said. I could feel myself blushing at being found so stupid in his eyes. "Then I shall teach you. Come, put your hands thus. Now simply do as I do." Before I knew what was happening, I was skipping about the room, Stephen's big hands holding me and guiding me so well I could not miss a step. Father and Giles moved the board close against the wall to give us room. Ted Leicester clapped his hands in time to the merry tune, and suddenly Elizabeth rose and grasped Father's hands, and then they were dancing too. I had never seen Elizabeth dance, and I wanted to watch, but I was so busy keeping my own feet moving, there was little time to spare observing hers. I did note that she moved as lightly and easily as the girl, even though the new child has already thickened her waist. Her eyes were shining, and little wisps of her brown hair bounced from her cap, curling softly against her reddened cheeks. Giles took up the clapping, and we danced and danced until we were all gasping, when we threw ourselves back on our stools. I felt more excited than I ever had in my life. Stephen's eyes, so clear blue they are close to green, kept sparkling at me, making me want to laugh. He started singing, then in a voice I consider exceeding fine, bold songs, in some of which Father joined him, both of them roaring out the flighty words at the top of their lungs. Father filled their tankards again, and the songs got louder, with Ted Doty leading the air with his pipe. And of a sudden there came a knock on the door, so thunderous we were all startled into silence. Father opened it, and there stood the governor, rain pouring from his hat, his cloak soaked black. "Good evening, Will," Father said pleasantly, while behind him Ted Doty slipped the flute inside his shirt. "Good evening, Stephen," the governor replied. "Won't you come in?" Governor Bradford stepped inside the door, his face long and serious. "Have a nip of brandy, Will. 'Twill dry out the rain." The governor looked at the bottle longingly, but shook his head. "It grieves me to say this, Stephen," he said, "but you well know there are laws against a master and his servants drinking and idling together." "But on such a night, Will," Father protested. "Surely there is no harm. There are better things to do with our time." "I feel certain there are some worthwhile chores to which your men can put their efforts. It is not meet for hired men to have idle hands." Father just looked at the governor, knowing from experience that no words he might say would help. "As you say, Will," he murmured. He replaced the top on the bottle of brandy with a little sigh. "There shall be no more tonight. Isaac and I will determine what your fine is to be," the governor said as he turned to the door. Then, as though he had forgotten something, he turned back and added politely, "I trust you are in good health, Elizabeth?" "Quite, thank you," Elizabeth said demurely, her hands folded quietly in her lap. With a little nod at the rest of us, the governor departed, ducking his head against the driving rain. Father closed the door. I felt shocked. I had never known my father to be fined for anything, nor even openly reproached. It seemed a dreadful embarrassment. A tiny sound made me look quickly to Elizabeth, who was sitting with her hands covering her mouth, trying to stifle, of all things, a surge of giggling. "Oh, Stephen," she gasped, her eyes sparkling, "suppose he had come a few moments sooner. Whatever would have happened had he seen such dance?" Father stood looking down at her, and then he grinned. "What could he have done, Lizzie? Did he take but one look at you, he would have asked you to be his partner. It cost Father 40 shillings, but he said it was worth it. As for me, all I can think of now is Stephen." October 1622. There have been times this year when I have felt that the most important thing in the world would be to have my fill of eating. Our diet goes in a tiresome circle of corn, fish, a little venison or wild duck or goose, then back to corn again. In the summer there are berries, and a kind of wild plum that is moist and sweet, and then corn. Cornbread, corn pudding, corn porridge, dried corn, boiled corn, but always corn. Each one's ration from the general stores has been cut until any meal is but a great deal of bussing and the smallest portion of food. And yet, except for little Oceanus, but now I find there are others near us who are not so fortunate. A few days ago I was standing by the door, the morning being mild for early fall, combing my hair. I bethought myself it needed washing, but there were chores awaiting me and no time to do it then. Just as I laid down the comb and began to twist my hair in the coils that I fastened with wooden pins and cover with my cap, John Cook walked by. Seeing me, he paused, we exchanged a morning greeting, and he approached the door, smiling shyly. "Your hair looks like corn silk," he said. I was holding a pin between my teeth, ready to secure my hair with it, which made speech a little difficult, but I had to answer him. "Corn silk," I blurted. "Belike it is corn silk. When there is not on the diet but corn, 'tis wonder we don't have corn teeth, corn eyes." I stopped to take the pin from my mouth and plunge it into my hair. "Even ears of corn," John said, grinning. Then he sobered. "Still, think of the man in Wessagusset, Con. They would welcome corn more than gold." I knew that Thomas Weston, who had helped to finance the Mayflower's voyage, and who was now causing our governor and his aides much worry by his importunate demands, had sent some 70 Englishmen to form a new settlement 20 or so miles north of here on the Massachusetts Bay. I had heard father speak of this place, called Wessagusset, but with the unfriendly feeling between Plymouth and Mr. Weston, there had been little visiting back and forth, and I had nigh forgot the colony was there. This I told John. "They are even hungrier than we are," he said. "They came ill-provisioned and have had no time to raise any sort of crop. What they did bring, and the further food that they traded the Indians for, they have long since eaten. Now they have nothing left with which to trade, and until Weston sends another ship, they are virtually without food, save what they can catch. Let them come here. I will gladly give them my share of corn," I said. "Governor Bradford has given them a little. We have none to spare ourselves," and that was soon gone. "But what do they do now?" I asked, sitting down in the doorway, where the morning sun was warm on the street. John sat down beside me. "Some of them have become servants to the Indians," he said. "They carry water and firewood for the Indians in exchange for a handful of corn. They have given up their blankets, most of their clothes, whatever the Indians will take." "But that is dreadful," I said, shocked through. "They are Englishmen. How can they lower themselves that way? For hungry men will do many things. Just a few days ago, there was one of them digging for a few clams, and he was so weakened from lack of food that, sticking badly in the mud, he could not move." "What happened to him?" "He died there."
"Like that? In the mud?"
"Yes." I shuddered. "What will become of them?" "I know not." "Are there women among them? Children?" I thought of Oceanus. "No, not but men." "Thank God for that," I breathed. John looked at me with the trace of a smile. "You think so poorly of men, Con."
"It isn't that. I know, I was but teasing."
John leaned forward, picked up a small pebble from the ground, tossing it lightly up and down in his hand. After a moment of silence, he said, "You are much with Stephen Dean, Con." I widened my eyes at him. "He shared our roof. He is a friend to all of us." "Will Hilton and Tom Prince shared the same roof, but I do not see you making such friends of them."
"Will Hilton is married," I said primly. "He but waits for his wife. In any case..."
"In any case, they no longer live with you," John interrupted. "They have their own quarters in the common house with others of the wifeless men." "That is not what I was going to say. I was about to point out that I find it no business of yours who my friends are, and I regard Master Dean's company as most pleasant."
"You did not need to tell me that," John said gloomily.
Then he looked straight at me, his long dark face solemn. "Do you plan to wed with him?" I rose quickly to my feet, giving my skirt a little twitch. "In truth, John, I cannot see that it is your affair," I said indignantly. And then, because I could not help but be curious, I said, "Why do you ask?" John rose too, his head level with mine, since he is not as tall as Stephen. "He is not right for you, Con, that's all. He is a boisterous rogue, and you deserve better." "Like you, I suppose. I have little to offer any girl, yet, but I have great fondness for you, Con." To my surprise, I found myself giving him what can only be called a coquettish glance, though I have promised myself never to behave lightly again. "Well, sir," I said, with what I trust was an airy laugh, "you do me an honor." John frowned. "Stop behaving like Desire Minter. It does not suit you." His quick remark shook the silliness out of me.
You seem to be very sure just what and who is right for me, I flung at him. With such keenness of perception, 'tis wonder you do not also see that whoever it may be, it will not be you. And I flounced into the house and closed the door. Going about my chores, my mind kept harking back to the things that John had said. Was Stephen really a rogue, or was it but jealousy on the part of Master Cook? Stephen is in truth a spirited man, with a little regard for authority, but not since Governor Bradford berated him and the others at Christmas have I seen him do anything worse than drink a bit too much, so that he becomes loud and roughened in his speech, but never belligerent. Stephen works hard, being strong and ambitious for himself, and I do believe he will make his mark in Plymouth. When I bethought how John had spoken of my hair, and I wondered what Stephen would say of it, were he to see it long and loose, which he has never done, I suddenly had the modest thought to wash it and sit in the sun to let it dry when he would be coming by on his way to supper. I know that to draw attention to oneself is not meet, but that same devil urged me on, so that as the afternoon began to fade, I was gathering herbs in the garden by the front of the house, my hair falling long and damp and straight and shining around my shoulders and to my waist. I kept one eye on the street, and at last saw him coming in the south gate that breaks the palisade between the Brewster and Billington houses, directly across from ours. His jacket was thrown across one shoulder, his stride was slowed by weariness. Pretending I noticed him not, I rose with my herbs and shook the hair back from my face. Stephen stopped in front of our house. "Well, look at this, you horse in Plymouth, but there's a yellow mare's tail if I ever saw one." A mare's tail, indeed. I looked up in anger, my poor attempts at coquetry completely dashed. Had I known your sensibilities might be offended, I would have covered the mare's tail with my cap, I said. Stephen moved closer to the little fence that surrounds the garden and the house, leaning against it and reaching out until he grasped a thick handful of hair. He pulled me gently toward him. "You knew full well I would be coming by, Con," he said. "Do not try your fancy tricks on me." I tried to toss my hair free, but he held it tight. "And mare's tail or no," he went on, looking very straight into my eyes with his bright green-blue ones, "I should like to see this hair spread on my pillow." I was aghast. How dared he speak to me like that, as though I were some common strumpet. "Before that ever comes to pass, your hair and mine will both be white," I snapped, and tried again to pull away from him. "Let me go!" He loosed my hair gently and smoothed it back from my face with his big hand. "I go," he murmured, "and best you hide this shining mop beneath your cap when I am by, lest I forget myself." And with that he kissed me very quickly on the top of my head and marched on down the street to supper. In a fine taking, I ran into the house, threw the herbs on the board, and coiled my hair as quickly as I could, pushing the pins in so hard they nigh went through my scalp, and settling my cap securely. By the time Elizabeth came in a few minutes later with some wild onions she had found near Tambrook, I was busy at the fire, so that she took no notice of my flushed cheeks. Will I never learn to behave in a meek and modest manner? Perhaps Stephen is justified when he speaks to me as to a common woman. Yet I want him to notice me, and he will not if I walk away with downcast eyes, saying nothing. Is it better to be demure and unnoticed, or brazen enough to rouse a spark in a man's eye? Oh me, if only there were a horn book to guide a growing maid as there is to teach the youngest child. December 1622. It is hard for me to believe that we have been here more than 2 years. The days and weeks and months go by in constant work and constant hunger. The clothes of many are ragged and few of us have cloth or other clothes which can be remade. My rosy dress, once my pride and most becoming in its color, is now a sad thing, worn and faded. The second gown that Captain Standish gave us has been used by Elizabeth to cover her expanding belly since the new child comes soon. Gowns did truly talk with Father on many occasions about the unwillingness of our people to work in the fields for the common good, and others must have felt the same, for Governor Bradford met with Father and the others whom he considered his advisers, and they have ordained that each man may plant and reap for himself in goodly plots of ground apportioned by the governor. Ours is on the bank of Town Brook, and Father and Giles go each day to gaze proudly on the hard, snowy earth and plan the planting of it. There seems now to be a feeling of hope among our men, hope that they will be able to raise a crop to stave off the threat of starvation. Father says 'tis only to be expected, since any man will work harder for himself than for his neighbor, and that ownership gives him pride and a will to work. God knows I hope this is true, for constant hunger is a fearsome thing. It can drive men to degrading and abominable deeds, and it is surely responsible for the end of Wassagasset. I do not understand all of what has taken place, but from what I have heard Father saying, it does seem that one John Sanders, second governor of Wessexett, proposed to take corn from the Indians by force, since Weston's men no longer had anything with which to trade or buy. Master Sanders sent word to Governor Bradford of what he meant to do, and we sent word back that it was most ill-advised and could only result in sad trouble, not only for the Weston colony, but for Plymouth too. Even though Master Sanders at last agreed not to pursue his plan, the Massachusetts tribe, who like us not, had wind of it, and spread the word of the proposed treachery to other Indian tribes. Thus, when Captain Standish went out in the shallop to bring back some supplies for which our governor had bargained, in friendly fashion with the Indians, he was met with what he felt was suspicion and enmity. Now that it is all over, Father says that the captain may have imagined such treatment. Father says a small chimney is quickly fired, and in truth Miles Standish is a small man, whom some of the boys call Captain Shrimp. In addition, this continual gnawing at our vitals makes us unlike ourselves in many ways. In any case, whether he was truly treated ungraciously, or whether it was in his mind, he took great offense, and determined to dispose of whom he considered enemies. By now there was great unrest on every hand, with all the tribes hereabouts suspicious of the white men, whether they were of Wessexett or Plymouth, and all the white men suspicious of the Indians, not knowing whom to trust nor believe. At last Captain Standish took Hobomok and 8 men, heavily armed, of whom, to my surprise, Father was not one, and this by his own choice and not from cowardice, I know, and sailed to Wessexett. There, with the connivance of Master Sanders and others of Weston's ungodly crew, he lured some of the leaders of the Massachusetts into a building by promise of a feast, and how they could have been unwitting enough to have faith in such an invitation I cannot see, and there set upon and killed them all. There are those in Plymouth who say that it had to be done, lest we be the victims instead of the Indians, but there are others who find it hard to condone such behavior. For my part, I know not what to think. To know that any man could kill in such cold blood, not in an open battle, but by a ruse, makes me greatly disturbed. And yet, in truth, the Massachusetts are a devious and crafty tribe, and mayhap it was the only way. The sad remainder of Weston's men, those who somehow have not died from hunger, have left Wessexett in fear, lest the Indians revenge themselves upon them, and have sailed in their little ship, the Swan, to a safer, they trust, harbor, and thence in time to England. And so Wessexett is empty, and our palisade has a heavier guard, and I find it hard to agree with those who think our captain is a hero. From what I have seen of the Indians in these parts, they are but men of a different color than we, but at heart they are the same. I recall how terrified I was of them at first, and what great fear I knew when Samoset came to our house, and how that fear was eased by his behavior. I feel the softness of Minnetaxet's moccasins on my feet, and I know that these people are not our enemies. I think of Squanto, too, who, but a month ago, was stricken with a raging fever, which none of our most careful dosing could ease, and who died, leaving his few treasured possessions to the governor, and asking that he be prayed for that he might go to our English God in heaven. And I know that Squanto was our friend and constant aid while he lived with us. Surely we need not have feared people such as these, and surely what Captain Standish did need not have been done. But 'tis done now, with no way to alter it. It makes my heart heavy. February 1623. Tonight, as I sit writing by the flickering light of a pine knot, and oh, for some proper tallow, so we could dip candles, there is a new and strange and welcome sound in the house, the lusty crying of a babe. Elizabeth's son, Caleb, was born this afternoon. He is a sturdy child, and though Elizabeth now lies weak and tired, she smiles to hear him. 'Twould seem all is well with them both, though with the little food we have had, now there is rarely even corn, and I could bite my tongue out for the way I spoke of it, since at the very least it helps to fill our bellies. I know not how she had the strength to bear him, nor how he emerged into this hungry world so healthy. But let me go back to the start of the day. I sat in Priscilla Alden's house this morning, helping her to adjust a dress that was her mother's so that it would fit Priscilla's new girth, for she, too, is with child. As we carefully ripped the old seams and sewed the new, we talked. I admired the furniture and household goods that John has built for them, working, Prissy says, long hours into the night. There may not be food, she said, but 'tis sure there is an abundance of wood, and this John takes as a personal blessing. You should see him hold a board, Con. He turns and rubs and fingers it, looking for just the way to use it so that the grain will show its best advantage. I swear he becomes as enamored of wood as of me. To her anything but wooden, I teased her, as I held the widened garment across her stomach to ascertain the fit. The governor has commissioned John to make him a great bedstead, Prissy said. Well, 'tis right that he should have things in his house that reflect his position, I murmured, absorbed in how to gain another 2 inches to fit Prissy's swelling waist. If you are right, then I believe his position is about to change. I looked up quickly to catch a smug expression on Prissy's face. What do you mean? John says if ever he saw a marriage bed, this is one. A marriage? To whom? I know not, but to no one here, I think. Then, I was confused, you mean others are expected? Prissy leaned forward slightly, her hand on my knee, her eyes sparkling with her bit of gossip. They say that Will Bradford sent letters back on the Fortune, and with Weston's men on the Swan, though when those will reach England is a question. But of course he would have sent letters back, I said. That means nothing. To a mistress southward? I refused to be convinced that it could be his sister for all that, but it isn't. I know whose sister it is, though, she paused in the most exasperating manner. I put the dress firmly aside. Prissy, I said, if you are going to tell me, then tell me and leave off the teasing. If you are not, then finish your gown yourself. Hastily, she picked up the gown and laid it back on my lap. I will tell you. The little I know, I will tell you. Resuming my sewing, I settled back to listen, pleased as all women are when they have a tiny nut of news to chew on. Mistress Southworth was born Alice Carpenter, and she is sister to Mistress William Wright, who came on the Fortune, and to Dr. Fuller's first wife, Agnes. There is another sister also, a Mistress Juliana Morton, but I know little of her save that her husband George and the governor have been friends for many years. The governor has known Mistress Southworth for a long time. Also, some say since before he married poor Dorothy. But, Prissy, all this does not mean that he plans to wed with her. You are right, of course, Con, and yet I do hope he is. He needs a wife. I know a bit more, too. What? The governor is not the only one who has been writing letters to England addressed to a female. Prissy, I said threateningly, starting to lay the dress aside again. 'Twas Captain Standish. In truth? I tried to imagine the small, belligerent, bloodthirsty warrior composing a tender love letter and gave up in despair. Are you sure he did not ask John to write it for him? I asked. 'Tis hard to think of him being brave enough to propose to a woman. You must not tease me about him, Con. I cannot help but admire the little man, even though I could not marry him. And if you were going to talk about that sad affair at Wissagasset, she added quickly, please don't, as I truly do not know what to think of it. Nor I admitted. There was the sound of running feet on the street outside, and then a great knocking at the door, and I heard Giles' voice. Con, are you there? Priscilla rose quickly, opening the door. Yes, she's here, Giles. What is it? 'Tis our mother. She thinks the babe is about to be born, Con. I had a sudden queasy sensation in my stomach. I had never helped deliver a child, and the very thought of it filled me with fear. Is there no one else you could call? I asked Giles. Giles looked at me just as father does sometimes, his chin high, his eyes slightly narrowed. She told me to call you, Con. Are you coming? Yes, I said. Yes, Giles, I'm coming. I followed him out the door. Can I be of help? Priscilla said faintly. I know little about it. Still, I could not help laughing at her obvious reluctance. Two of us who know nothing would be twice as bad. Bide where you are. She looked mightily relieved as she waved after us. Giles opened the door of our house and then stood back to let me enter. I'll split some wood, he said, his voice gruff. I would be little help. I agreed with him, but I felt most fearsome as I walked into the house, knowing not what to expect. Elizabeth was spreading some of Oceana's small clothes on the back of Father's chair and setting it before the fire so they would warm. There was a beading of sweat on her forehead, and her breath was coming quickly, but she managed to smile. Poor Constance, she said, I had not meant to need you. She sat down on the edge of the bed, leaning forward and gasping so that I went to her quickly. Tell me what to do. After a moment, she straightened up and took a deep, easy breath. I was going to call for Ellen Billington. She may be a bad-tempered woman, but she is a good midwife. I will fetch her. She has gone with her family and the Brewsters way past Townbrook to hunt for mussels. I think we cannot wait for her return. She looked up at me and gave a little laugh. Seems 'twill just be you and me, Constance. I grinned, and I could feel that the grin looked like father's. Never you fear, I said. We'll manage. Now get into bed like a respectable woman, and do what you can to get this over with. It was truly remarkably simple. I could feel Elizabeth straining to bear her child, but she never cried out, though at times she gave a deep animal grunt that seemed to relieve her. She had prepared the few things I needed and guided me with calm, explicit directions, and there, finally, was my tiny half-brother, red and wrinkled and slippery, but responding to my hand with a shrill, complaining cry. There was a deal to be done, but somehow, with Elizabeth instructing me, I managed it all, having little time to wonder or to fear. When at last the bed and all the room were clean and the child, wrapped comfortably in the warmed clothes, was sleeping by his mother, I stood looking down at her. Her eyes had great shadows beneath them, and her face was pale, but I knew she was all right. And somehow, a great love for Elizabeth filled me, and for this scrap of life which I had helped to enter the world. Leaning, I kissed Elizabeth softly on the cheek. "Sleep now," I said. "All is well." "Thank you, Constance." Her voice was sweet in its whispered softness. I opened the door. The westering sun was dipping behind Fort Hill, and the reddened light filled the room, touching the edge of the newly smoothed bed. Stepping outside, I folded my arms and stood breathing in the salty, tangy air, feeling a surge of strength and confidence such as I had never known. I could hear the ring of Giles' axe somewhere behind the house, and thought to go and tell him of the babe, but just then I saw Father coming up the street from the fields. He turned in at our gate and paused, looking at me. "Well, daughter," he said, "you stand there with your head high, as though you could conquer the world." "I can," I said, and smiled at him. "I just did. Go inside, Father. Your new son is waiting for you." He looked at me a moment in astonishment, and then burst open the door. "Elizabeth," he bellowed, and then, as I heard him move quietly to the bed, "Bess, sweet Bess," and his voice was as soft as a woman's. Noiselessly, I drew the door closed and went in search of Giles.